Okay, so we have a PA here. So can everybody hear me all right? Right. If you can't hear me, then just put your hand up and so on. Especially maybe if it starts raining, we might need to have a bit of assistance. Okay, very good. So we're here to talk about the path to happiness. What a ridiculous concept. As if you can have a path to happiness. Why don't you just be happy? Then you don't have to go in the path. striving and striving to be happy. You know, in the American Declaration of Independence, they say that we all have the innate right to three things: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Right? You notice what's a bit unusual there. We have the right to life, we have a right to liberty, but we don't have a right to happiness. Yeah? We have a right to pursue happiness. Yeah? We have a right to the pursuit. And that's almost uncanny in how precisely it defines our modern life and what we're actually doing. Yeah? We're spending our lives pursuing happiness. And the more and more we pursue it, the faster and faster it runs away. So why don't we have a right to happiness? Yeah? Why don't we have a right to happiness? I guess we see happiness as being something which is elusive, I don't know, hard to define, individual, all of those things. But on the other hand, so is liberty, right? Liberty is elusive and it's hard to define and it's different for different people. So I don't know why we don't think that we have a right to be happy in the same way that we have a right to live. In any case, the pursuit of happiness. And of course what the great lesson that we come from spiritual practice is that we only really find happiness when we stop pursuing it. And that's what takes the courage. That's what takes the time. From a Buddhist point of view, the way that the Buddha described the path of practice, because he talked about it as a gradual letting go, a gradual emptying, letting go of all of the stuff that we carry around, the burdens that we carry, and all of the things that cause us suffering. And more that we let go of those things, the more and more that we unburden ourselves, the more and more we experience happiness. And the happiness that we experience in that way is of different kinds. And again, this is one of the things which the Buddha analyzed and talked about in very kind of nice ways. Some of the kinds of happiness that we experience are, we feel a happy feeling. This is the most obvious kind of thing, right? And if you feel some kind of pleasure or pleasant feeling or something like that, you meet an old friend or something like that and you smile and laugh. These kinds of happiness are fairly obvious. Then there's the kind of happiness that comes from doing a good day's work. Right? I mean, if you've got a job or something that you're doing that you think is meaningful and worth doing, and you put a lot of effort into it, and you look back and you think, okay, I've got that done. It makes you feel happy. Kind of happiness you get from generosity and kindness is also another form of happiness. And these are all kinds of happiness which you can experience. Right? Then there are other forms of happiness which you're not necessarily going to experience. They don't necessarily have any feeling associated with them. Right? And so this is where the Buddha's analysis of happiness becomes quite subtle. So what does it mean to say that you can have a form of happiness that doesn't have any form of feeling associated with it? Well, for example, think about the happiness of freedom. The happiness of a man who's just been let out of jail. Right? Now, I've never been in jail. I've been advised that I should be. I have friends who went to jail and really enjoyed their meditation and time while I was there. But I've never actually been to jail yet. Maybe one day it's something I'll be able to achieve and look back proudly in my life. But what is it like when you get free from jail? Even if we haven't done it ourselves, we can imagine what it's like. What's it like to step outside of those gates and be free? What do you actually feel at that time? Well, of course, there's no single thing which you feel at that time, is there? If you have half a dozen people released from jail at the same day, they'll all feel different things. Yeah? And they'll go and do different things. They'll experience happiness in quite different ways. But they'll all have something in common. And that's that feeling of freedom. And the feeling of freedom is not something you can define, not something you can pin down. It doesn't have any essence in itself, except for the fact that you're freed from that imprisonment. So when we do our spiritual practice, all of these different forms of happiness deepen and grow through the development of the path. Some things very obvious, some things very subtle. Some things very short-lasting, some things very long-lasting. But all of them, all of these kinds of spiritual forms of happiness are things which the Buddha only praised. Very important to notice this and to be very clear about this in your mind. Because there's unfortunately, a lot of meditation teachers in the 20th century who seem to have some problem with happiness. I don't know why this is, but you'll read a lot of books and hear a lot of teachers who will say things like, you know, you have to be careful of feeling too much happiness, you'll get attached to it, and if you feel too much pleasure in your meditation, you'll be attached to it, and watch out. But I was told when I started meditation. Huh? This is very disturbing. It has this very unhealthy relationship to pleasure and happiness. The Buddha said happiness is good, pleasure is good. Nothing wrong with it. Huh? What the Buddha did say was that there are some forms of pleasure, some forms of happiness, which lead have give you pleasure in the short term and lead to suffering in the long term, like ice cream. Oh, too much chocolate, all these kinds of things. And so the Buddha said, okay, well, those kinds of pleasures you have in moderation. But then there are other forms of pleasure which are not only present now, but lead to greater and deeper forms of happiness in the future. And the Buddha said, go for it. Have as much as you like of those ones. And of course, that's the pleasures and the happiness that comes from practicing the path, comes from doing good, comes from meditating, all of those things. And so you can never be too happy from doing all those things. So when we're doing our spiritual practice, we should always kind of bear this in mind and remember that we have a duty to be happy. If you're not happy, you're not doing your job. Which, of course, is another source of depression, isn't it? Right? Because we're not always happy. And sometimes you can read in the surveys, there was a survey a while ago that said Buddhists are happier than other people. And you're like, oh, I'm supposed to be a Buddhist, but I don't feel very happy. Well, can you listen? But, of course, Buddha, as a master psychologist, also talked about this problem as well, which is called spiritual depression. Niramisa Domanasa. It's very nice to know that there's a Pali word for the problem that you have. Niramisa Domanasa. Spiritual depression. Yeah? And I met somebody who had a very severe case of that the other day, just a couple of weeks ago. And he spent 5 years on an ashram in India, sort of meditating really, really hard to get enlightened. And that hadn't worked. And he was in despair. It's like, I was that
close. He said, I can never do that again. You know, that was so much hard work. I just don't have it in me anymore to do that. And I knew, and you could see it was so much despair that he had from this feeling of longing for this spiritual release and this liberation that he just wasn't there. And of course, it's the very force and the very effort that he's putting into it, which is what's holding him back. But it will take him time to learn that. So sometimes when we're practicing, we don't necessarily feel happy, we feel depressed or sad or something, and this is okay as well. This is also part of the path. Remember that the Buddha, in his practice, also went through periods where he felt despairing, when he felt lost, when he felt fearful. So these things will happen, and we shouldn't worry about it. But it's quite okay to think, well, look, we want to do our spiritual practice. We want to keep on meditating. So we should find a way of meditating that's going to make us happy. Right? That's what I thought when I started meditating. I did all these different kinds of meditation. And, you know, like breath meditation, and I'd do that, and sometimes that was good. And I enjoy the breath meditation, but sometimes it's kind of boring. And sometimes you just sort of sit there, and then an hour later you're like, what was all that about? Then I do the slightly Vipassana meditation, and also you know, had some wonderful meditations through that and learned a lot. But you're also, you know, it's quite hard work. And I did like sort of body contemplations and symmetry contemplations and all of these kinds of things. And then I tried metta meditation, loving kindness meditation. And it's like, whew, amazing. It blew my head off. I was like, wow. You can just sit there and do this meditation and you just feel so happy. You feel so happy just straight away. And I know not everybody has that response to doing metta meditation, loving kindness meditation. But some people do. And it is certainly a characteristic of this meditation. The meditation on loving kindness, the Buddha said, Suvabhan Chitran Samadhi with you. So quickly brings the mind to samadhi, to unification. And that's why, because it's associated with so much pleasure and so much happiness. So if we can do loving kindness meditation, and if we feel that the feeling and sensation of happiness that comes through that, then we can bring the mind to clarity and peace quickly. We can enjoy our meditations every time, and we also set up our mind. And this is very important. We set up our mind to associate meditation with happiness. Right? Now, you might think that you're tough. You might think that, oh, I can sit there and sit through pain and do all of these things. But you're not. Willpower is not going to get you enlightened. Right? You'll never determine your way to getting enlightened. The mind just doesn't work that way. The mind works by, if you look at how your mind works, it's always responding to pleasure and pain, the stimulus and the drawing away. And if you give something to the mind that draws the mind along, that draws the mind in with this feeling of pleasure and happiness, then you'll want to keep on doing it. You'll want to come back to your meditation. You'll feel reluctant to finish your meditation. You'll feel happy to go into it. And whenever you try even other forms of meditation, you'll also be able to bring that feeling of happiness and pleasure into those meditations quite easily, because your mind is trained to see that perception. So this is the practice of loving kindness meditation, which I'm going to talk about this evening. And we'll do some guided meditation in just a minute, and I'll just explain briefly about how this meditation goes. So when we come to meditate, we meditate by making the intention and the direction of loving kindness very clear in our minds. Okay? And we do that by using words. Right? And so conventionally the words we use in Buddhism is may I be happy. Don't worry about the words. People always say, can I do this? Can I use other words? Can I do this? Can I do that? I'm not here to tell you what to do, alright? Do what you like. You have my permission to sit there and do anything in your meditation. I'm just giving you some things which have proven useful, that's all. And so you can try them if you like. Start with may I be happy, and then we wish may various other people be happy, and finally we end up may all sentient beings be happy. So the ultimate expansion, the breadth of loving kindness, is for all sentient beings to be happy. But to get there, we have to start with where we're at. If we begin by saying may all sentient beings be happy, then it's very nice. It can be a form of what they call something called spiritual elevationism or spiritual bypassing. And what happens is that you can have this concept, this idea in your mind of all sentient beings, and it's a very wonderful idea, and you can wish may all sentient beings be happy, and it's all wonderful. But can you wish yourself to be happy? Oh no, I couldn't do that. What about the person that I love most in the world? Can I wish them to be happy? Oh, that's really hard. Yeah. And my next door neighbour, I can't wish, but I can wish all beings be happy. Yeah. Yeah. So there's something going wrong there. We're kind of in denial. Okay. So what we do when we're doing the metta meditation, or in kindness meditation, we start very gradually. We start close to home, and when we're very comfortable and feel abundant and full with doing that meditation, little bit by little bit, we start to extend that outwards. So for this evening, this is what we're going to be doing. We're going to be just starting with guided meditation, and we'll just do that little bit of the beginnings of this metta meditation. So what do I mean when I'm talking about metta or loving kindness? And loving kindness is simply the wish to be happy, wish to be happy for oneself, the wish to be happy for others. And this is the basis of that very beautiful emotion that we call love. And real love is just the wish for happiness. Happiness for oneself and happiness for others. Now of course when we use that word love in English, it becomes very complex. And it becomes mixed up with all kinds of things. Because of course our minds are complex, our relationships are complex, our attitudes to other people are complex. And so usually we find that the ones that we love the most are also the ones that we hate the most. Right? So what we feel when we feel love for somebody is a complex mix of all different kinds of things. And often what's very prominent there is that we feel that we love somebody because of how they make you feel. Right? I love you because you make me happy. Yeah, I love you because I like to spend time with you. I love you because I need you. Yeah? And so all this is about what you want to get from somebody else. Yeah? Whereas real metta has nothing to do with any of those kinds of things. It's not trying to get anything at all. It's only about wanting to give. Yeah? That's the crucial distinction between metta and kind of the more worldly or complex forms of love that we have in the world. So usually your love is a mixture of both of those things. It's not entirely selfish, but it's not entirely giving either. It's a mixture. So what we're trying to do with the metta meditation is to identify and isolate specifically that very simple and pure emotion which only wants to give. And this is why the Buddha gave the simile that the metta is like the love of a mother for her only child. So when imagine that baby's been born and the mother first holds the baby. At that moment, it's just pure love and pure metta. And she doesn't want to get anything from that child, right, at that point. Maybe later on she does. Yeah? Later on, the child grows up and they have all kinds of complex emotions between each other. Right? But just at that moment, it's very simple and very pure. It's very primal. Metta, loving kindness, is an extremely primal emotion. Right? And I say something's primal, it doesn't necessarily mean it's kind of bestial or vicious or anything like that, but it's primal. It's that which is the force that brings together. You know, you see it in the animal world all the time. So that which is a pure and simple and childlike notion of wishing to be happiness, this is what we're looking at for the metta. So we begin with those words, simple words, may I be happy. But the words are only there to give the mind some direction and some framework. What we're really looking for is the feeling. Metta is a feeling. And through the meditation, we're able to, first of all, get in contact with the feeling, to realize it, right? To actually experience it directly. And secondly, to develop it. Right? To make so much more of it that, you know, than you ever thought was possible. Now, one of the things which is a characteristic of all forms of Buddhist meditation, right, is that they're all based on reality. Right? Well, it's not about sort of some imagined, you know, god or goddess or something like that out there. It's not about some fantasy world or imagine I'm sitting in a cave and I'm imagining dolphins swimming around or something like that. These are not proper Buddhist meditation. Buddhist meditation, you base it on some reality. You base it on the experience of your breath or the experience of your body or something like that. And one of those realities that we base meditation on is the reality of the metta. It's an emotion. Okay? And so it's called metta-bhavana. Metta-bhavana, which they normally translate as metta-meditation, loving-kindness meditation. But that misses a very important nuance of the Pali word. Metta-bhavana, crucial meaning of bhavana, what it actually means is to make more of something. Yeah? To make more of it. Metta meditation is to make more of loving kindness, right? But you can only make more of something that is already there. Yeah? Think about the implications of this, right? What we're doing with the loving kindness meditation, we're not inventing it. We're not fantasizing about it. We're not making something that isn't there. It's already there and already present inside each person here. Every person here has loving kindness. That's why we can do this meditation. Just like you all breathe. Right? You're all breathing. You're all feeling. You all have bodies. This is why these realities are what the meditation is based on. In the same way, we base meditation on loving kindness is based on the fact that we all experience loving kindness. Maybe we can't see it, maybe we don't know it, maybe it gets lost, maybe we're confused, maybe we get disconnected from it, maybe it gets covered up with so many other things and we've forgotten what it's like. But it's there. It's still there. So what we do in the meditation, we're not trying to force it, we're not trying to make it calm or anything like that. Just be very, very patient. And you just sit there. Endless patience. Endless acceptance of whatever happens. We sit there, we do the meditation, may I be happy, and so on. And you just sit there and wait. And patiently, patiently, patiently you wait. And you look and you watch. And one day, it will be there. And you see it. And you realize, oh, it was there all along. It was there all along. And I just didn't notice. How could I have not noticed that? How could I have been walking around with love in my heart for my whole life and I never even noticed? Yeah? That thing which is the most important is hidden. But once you do notice it, you can always find your way back there. Right? Once you notice it, you can always find your way back. You know where to look. You know what it feels like. And without too much difficulty, right, you'll be able to turn your mind and just sort of click. Ah, there it is. It's just like a shift of perception. And you can click and that feeling's there. And that's when the meditation really gets started and mind really starts to become peaceful. Okay, so we'll get started meditation for the next 30 minutes. Is that okay? 30 minutes of meditation, okay? We will do, in this meditation, we'll do loving kindness for oneself. and we'll do loving kindness for a loved person. Okay? And before we get going, I want you to all think of one loved person who you can do metta meditation for. Okay? So you want to choose somebody who you feel love for very simply and uncomplicated. Alright? Not the person that you love the strongest necessarily, because often the person you love the strongest you have complicated relationship with, right? It might be, but it might be the person that you might not love all that strongly, but you know, maybe like a niece or a nephew or something like that. Grandparent or grandchild or somebody you have a very simple relationship with. That's what we want, simple and childlike, not complicated and messed up, okay? That's good if you want to write a song or something like that. But for the meta meditation, you want to go to the therapist and, you know, out of compassion for the therapist, you want to keep on going back and back and back and give them a good livelihood, so then you get in all these messed up relationships, that's fine. But for meta meditation, we want simple and childlike, playful, right? Okay, they're not for working out your issues. No issues. You don't have any issues. Okay. So we'll do loving kindness for both those, for oneself and for a loved person, and we'll see during this meditation whether we can actually get that experience of metta and whether there's any contact with that. Okay. Sitting quietly. And let the mind settle back inside the body. Whatever tensions or pains that you feel in the body, just be aware of it. Oh, okay, that's how that feels like. Don't get too involved with it. Just what? Oh, okay. Get a good sense of how your body feels when it's sitting peaceful and still, right here, right now. leaving the mind settled in the heart, say to oneself the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Repeating those words again and again and again, evenly, steadily, clearly. Making it solid and dependable foundation for the mind. Gently and persistently bringing the mind back to that wholesome wish for one's own true happiness.
noticing that along with those words of loving kindness, there's something that's much deeper. And that's the feeling of loving kindness. Very soft, gentle feeling. Feeling of joy and happiness. And notice that feeling. Gently hold that in mind. Keeping it close. Keeping it safe. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Just hold that feeling, keep it close. Let it spread out and fill up your whole body. Until every part of your body
on the soles of the feet, to the top of the head, and the hair on your skin, to the marrow of your bones. You soak and seep through the beautiful, joyful loving kindness. Moving on to the metta for the love person. Keep in the mind just as it is, centered, grounded down inside your body. And bring in the name of that love person. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. Easily, evenly, steadily, keeping loving kindness for that loved one just the same as it was for oneself. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. And then taking that same loving kindness and spreading it out to all beings. May all beings be happy. May all beings be happy. May all beings be happy. Radiating out, spreading out right across the whole world. May all beings be happy. Coming to the end of the meditation. From the loved one come back to, or from all beings come back to the loved one. May the loved one be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. And to oneself, may I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. And letting the words of metta go. Letting the feeling of metta fade away and allowing the mind to come back to the neutral space, empty, open and clear. Mind empty and clear. Just take a minute to reflect back on the practice we've done together. Inquiring into cause and effect. What just happened? How did my mind change? not as attractive and distracting. Quite as helpful. What does my mind feel like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? Okay, so let's have a bit of a break for 5 minutes, and then we'll come back to it and jump in. We're going to have to use that.
Yeah. try it.
So obviously the rain will stop. Okay, so so far this evening we've spoke a little bit and meditated a bit on loving kindness. And I also want to talk a bit about compassion, some of the other things that we did. And in many ways, compassion is a bit more of a friendly kind of emotion. Isn't it? I don't believe it. Dalai Lama is all about compassion and these kinds of things. A few years ago, there was a movement started by Karen Armstrong. You know Karen Armstrong? A theologian and writer on religious things? Anyway, she won the TED Prize for that year, about 3 or 4 years ago now. And the winner of the TED Prize gets to wish for anything that they want. Right? So you've got to select the person who gets the prize quite well, right? And so her wish was to put compassion back at the heart of the world's religion, back at the heart of the world's civil society. And so they did that by starting a thing called the Charter for Compassion. And you can have a look at it online too. So they were quite a nice
feel and make these things, and so they put the shadow of compassion around in different places. And the local organisers managed to get the government to agree to put the shadow of compassion in Parliament House in Canberra. So that's pretty good, isn't it? We were the first national government to have the charter for compassion there. And we all went up there and did this ceremony where we got, you know, I was there and all these people from the organisers were there and all these politicians and senators and things like that. And we were right in the heart of Parliament House, right? Doing loving kindness and compassion meditation, right? Doing all of these things. On the very day that Julia Gillard is knifing Kevin Rudd in the back. First time, right? And we sort of came out, we're like, why are all these people here? What's going on? So I don't know whether that was, hopefully that wasn't the cause of any of the problems, but hopefully it might have been alleviated a little bit, but it certainly didn't make everybody act completely compassionately. And this, of course, is one of the problems, isn't it? You have these ideals, right? And sometimes when you have the ideals which are very pure, the more pure the ideals are, the easier it is to divorce from our reality. Right? The more pure the ideals are, the easier they are to divorce from our reality. But sometimes better to have slightly dirty ideals. Right? Slightly compromised ideals, slightly kind of lower our expectations. Not hope for too much out of the world, because the world is likely to disappoint you. I did a study once, one of the great stories in the Bible about compassion, of course, is the story of the Good Samaritan. And of course, you know the story where the man who fell in with thieves was beaten up and he was lying on the side of the road, and all these different people walked past him and ignored him, and only the Good Samaritan stopped and helped him. So one time the psychologist decided to do a test of this, and of course psychologists are sneaky bucks, always be nervous and afraid to be talking to a psychologist. You never know whether they're analysing you or studying you or something. Anyway, they decided to do this test, right? So how do you do this test? Well, you get a bunch of students, put them in a room, and you have to do a questionnaire on compassion, right? And then you have a priest come and teach to them the sermon of the Good Samaritan, and you see whether that affects their compassion ratings, right? That's how you do the test, except psychologists are much too sneaky for that, right? The actual test was that on the way into the hall, there was a man lying, beaten up, and needing help. And the priest had to walk past to see that man before they went in to give the sermon. And they found that the priest didn't stop. I'm in too much of a hurry to give my talk about compassion and to tell everybody about how they should stop and help the wounded, but I'm going to actually do it myself. I like to tell that story because it makes Christians look bad. No, really. I didn't mean that. I was just a bad story. I like to tell that story because it's a good reminder for myself as a spiritual teacher and as a Dhamma teacher to try to remember that, you know, if you fall into those problems, to remember that it's very easy for me to sit here and say, metta, loving kindness, compassion, let's all be happy, let's all love each other. But how does it actually work? How does it actually connect with our lives? When we talk about compassion, of course, to distinguish between these things is somewhat of an academic exercise, really. I mean, we just have different emotions and so on. But technically, the difference in Buddhism between loving kindness and compassion is that loving kindness is much more unstudied. Loving kindness is very simple and bright. It only knows about happiness, and loving kindness hasn't got wisdom. Right? I mean, loving kindness can go with wisdom and can grow and so on, but loving kindness itself doesn't have any wisdom. Right? Then think of that idea that the love of the mother for the child, right? It's not based on understanding the child or anything like that. It's just love. all the understanding and so on comes later. So it can support wisdom, it can help you grow wisdom and so on, but loving kindness itself doesn't need any wisdom. Compassion, on the other hand, is also based on wisdom. Yeah? So compassion is based on empathizing with and feeling with the suffering of somebody else. Yeah? And based on the wish, yeah? The intention to alleviate that suffering. So once you get into the realm of compassion, the emotion is much more mature. Right? It's much more complex. Yeah? And compassion is, for that reason, compassion is both more powerful ultimately, more powerful, richer, more profound emotion. Right? But also one that we have to be a little bit more careful about. With loving kindness, it's I think pretty much impossible to have any downside here, any visible or downside to things. It's pretty much impossible. With compassion, it's quite easy to tip over into a sense of over identification. Yeah? So you feel that somebody's suffering too much, and instead of being there to help alleviate and relieve it, you get dragged down into it. Yeah? Instead of pulling someone out of the water and jump in and then you realize, oh, I can't swim. Yeah? This is important to remember. And this is not just a theoretical problem. Right? This is a very real problem, which in fact, I would say, affects most people. And most people who try to act compassionately. If you work in any activist organization, volunteer organization and so on, they'll always talk about activist burnout. Right? It happens everywhere. People come along, they're very enthusiastic, they want to work for the cause. Usually about 2 years, they kind of go on that initial enthusiasm, and after a while, you don't see them around anymore. Right? It's just too much. Right? It's just too much. When I can take very extreme forms, when I was in Perth many years ago, we attended the funeral of a young girl, she was about 18 or something. We didn't know her, but her mother used to come to the monastery. And so we went to the funeral, and she was, I think, 18 or 19, and just started university. And you know, they were telling us all about her life. You know, her whole life was given to others. She would work at animal shelters, she would work at old folks' homes, she was always doing volunteer work and all these kinds of things. And then she killed herself. Too much to sin. Not to say there's anything wrong with the compassion, but the lack of wisdom that's going with it. Yeah? That's why it's always good when you're practicing to begin with the loving kindness. You begin with the loving kindness and then you get that sense of happiness and well-being and so on. It's very simple. Then you can start to say, okay, let's bring the compassion and let's see if we can deepen this. So let's not ignore the suffering that's going on in the world. Let's go out and let's feel it 100%. What can you do about it? So this is always this relationship between loving kindness and compassion and action is always a complex thing. It's never something we can actually solve. Now on the one hand, it's obvious that how we feel and how we act are related. Right? If we feel love and compassion, then we should act out of that. Right? And similarly, our actions should also help to nurture our love, right? If we perform loving actions and kind actions, then that would help us feel those things. Right? So on the one hand, they're always related. But on the other hand, the relationship is not a simple one. It's not an obvious one. Right? And so, in our practice, this is why, if you look in the Buddhist practice, you have, for example, the Noble Eightfold Path, and it has separate sections for how we act, like the right action, right livelihood, and so on, is one section, and then developing loving kindness and so on is on another section of the Eightfold Path. They're separate things. Again, obviously they're related and they support each other, but they're different kinds of things. And we can't just assume that because we feel love in our meditation, that we're going to act out of that. Right?
or that we're going to know how to act out of that. And just as similarly, we can't assume that because we're a kind person and we do good things, that we're therefore going to feel that, have that good meditation and all kinds. These things will support each other, but we need to nurture the relationship between the things consciously. So, if we begin with the simplest things and how we live our life and so on and so forth, how we, the choices that we make, how we talk to people, how we interact and all of these things. If we're coming from a point of view of loving kindness, then we're always coming from a point of view of what more can I give? How can I help this person? How can I try to alleviate suffering? Okay. I have these very beautiful descriptions in the Buddha Suttas about how monks, it's like an ideal vision of how monks can live together in a monastery. And it says that they look upon each other with kindly eyes, the eyes of metta, blending like milk and water. And whenever it rises in their minds to think, you know, what would I like to do, or how would I like this to be, then I think, why don't I put aside what I would like and do what these other animals would like? Okay? And that's how you live with loving kindness. So it's a reflective process. It doesn't just automatically happen, right? But it's just a reflective process. You understand what the metta is, you understand what the compassion is, and each time we make those choices, we reflect on it and we ask, what is the best way that we can act out of love and compassion? So the more that we do that, then the more that will help to support our meditation. And when we come to meditation, it can be actually a very useful thing to just begin the meditation and just ask yourself, how many kind things have I done today? Maybe you sit there and your mind's a blank. I haven't done anything kind today. And then if you think that you haven't done anything kind today, then you should be very ashamed of yourself. And immediately, don't try to meditate. You're wasting your time. If you haven't done anything kind the whole day and you try to meditate, what a waste of time that is. Run out of the house. Run down the street urgently looking for somebody who's suffering. Can I help you? Okay, get out of here. If I ask yourself that at the end of the day, is my life, has my day been rich and full with kindness? Right? That's the kind of life you could apply to. How many things have you done for somebody else? Right? And just go back and reflect on those things. And the beautiful thing is, it doesn't matter how big those things are. Right? You don't have to do lots of amazing things. Just very little things. Yeah? Is what makes a difference. Tiny small acts of kindness. Opening the door for somebody. Giving someone a glass of water, saying a polite word, smiling to somebody when you see them. All of these are little acts of kindness. Right? Replying to somebody's email in time. So you see, I think I broke 300 unreplied emails in my account today, so I'm doing very badly on that one. So you think about all of those things, and more that you fill our life with those things, and the more that will enrich and support our meditation. So when we come to do the meditation itself, that what we're doing in the meditation is something that's just happening at another level. It's happening at a much more refined level. Okay? Don't try to take the meditation and just do metta to everybody when you're walking down the street and this kind of thing. And I don't think that you can just, I'm feeling this good feeling and starting kind of meditation, and then I reach the end and say, I'm just going to keep this going now, and I'll beam at everybody, and I'll just like blast them with loving kindness, and they'll be happy.
You walk down the street with a big grin on your face. No, this is just being silly. Meditation is meditation. It's very, very important. One of the most important skills you can learn in meditation is to wrap it up. Pack up the meditation and put it away. Mindfully and carefully. Very, very important. Meditation is not the same as going around being mindful of what you're doing. Meditation is much deeper, it's much more intense, it's much more profound, it's much more subtle. Okay? And it needs its own space. So give it its own space. At the end of the meditation, pack it up and put it away. Why do we do this? Why? Because what we're doing in a meditation, right? We're dealing with emotions. Loving kindness, compassion, all of these things are emotions. Right? Now, emotions have a tendency to be quite formless. Right? They come and they go. Here they are, there they go, why are they here, why do you feel like this to come and that? And what we're trying to do in meditation is to develop them consciously so that we can say, okay, now we'll feel this period of metta and we'll bring it to an end. So we're developing a much more conscious relationship to our emotions. But in order to do that, we have to be able to give ourselves the permission to feel anything that we want. Right? This is how emotions work. If you try to control it, if you try to say, I'm going to be like this and not be like that, they'll just rebel. And when you go through the meditation, because our mind is full of delusion and confusion of all kinds of things, so many different kinds of things will happen to you while you're doing your meditation. You won't just sit there and just be peaceful and happy every time you sit and meditate, okay? Well, maybe you will, but if you are, I'm very jealous of you, okay? People like that are very annoying. No. Most people, meditation is kind of a mess, right? You sit there and you hear all different kinds of stuff, right? And that's okay. You have to have permission to tell us that you feel anything you like. Because there are boundaries on it. And if you start crying or start screaming or you feel all these things or you shiver or you shake or all kinds of things can happen, it's okay. Or if you don't feel anything at all, that's okay too. You sit there with nothing. I'm supposed to be doing metta meditation and my mind is this wasteland. I feel like there's curiosity going over the surface of Mars. There's nothing but dust everywhere, and I'm looking, hoping that sometime in the far distant past there's been a drop of moisture somewhere. And sometimes it feels like that, and that's okay too. Yeah? Because at the end of the meditation, it's going to be packed up and going to be put away. Right? And if you know that and understand that, and give yourself the confidence of that by consciously bringing the meditation to an end every time, like I showed when we did the guided meditation, every time we come back to the beginning of the meditation, put it away, leave it down, then we come out of meditation, we go and we do our thing. We don't try to bring it to meditation and apply it in that way into everything we're doing. We can if you're an expert, right? But we're not experts, we're just trying, we're just learning. So these are two distinct things. Right? They will support each other and they'll help each other, and we apply them consciously. We bring them and reflect on them and see how they can help each other. Right? But they're not the same thing. They're distinct. What we're doing in our meditation, what we're doing outside of meditation. So insofar as doing the actual practice of loving kindness meditation, of course, there are many different approaches, many different methods. Now, I taught the method of doing loving kindness, and I explained a little bit about why I sort of primarily teach loving kindness rather than teaching compassion. I think loving kindness is much more universally beneficial. Compassion, I think, you have to be a bit careful about it. But in any case, you can easily sort of adapt the method to compassion or different kinds of things. That's not a problem if you feel like doing that.
And if you, you know, want to try other methods and so on, methods are not important. But if you're going to try a particular method, just give it a good shot, that's all. Just sort of, you know, really try to understand it, try to apply it, and then see how it works. But if it doesn't work for you, that's okay. The Buddha taught so many different kinds of meditation. Right? In the Theravada tradition, they practically say that there are 40 different kinds of meditation that the Buddha taught. And that's only the tranquility meditation, the samatha meditation. And there's the vipassana, wisdom meditation, which is another whole organ. In fact, there's many more than that. So there's so many different kinds of ways of practicing, and all of them are good, all of them will help you to overcome the suffering and lead towards happiness, and that's all that matters. Okay, so don't get hung up on, you know, this piece is right, or that piece is right, or this piece is right, or that piece is right. All that we're doing when we're teaching meditation is giving you some tips, some hints, some guidelines that's been useful in the past. That's all. Take them off, see how it goes. Just work, don't worry about it, find something else. Yeah? And don't be scared. So when we do the modern kind of meditation, just be patient, little bit by little bit by little bit. Yeah? And if we're patient, and if you keep watching, hopefully, you'll learn to see what is that spark of loving kindness. What is that little thing? It's such a small thing. It's like the most fragile candle flame that you feel in your heart. It's so small, it's so nothing. But it's the most astounding, powerful force of the world. You're dipping them and you're keeping them down and down and down, further and further into your feeling until it becomes your whole world. And you realize how powerful and how transformative this meditation can be. Some think that just because I'm trying to meditation is pleasant and it's happy and so on, I've been saying it to be childlike and innocent and these kinds of things. Some think that it's a sort of beginner's meditation. It's an extremely profound practice. It's deeply transformative practice. And it's deeply transformative precisely because it gets us in touch with one of those fundamental qualities of our mind, the quality of loving kindness. Okay, so I should probably field some questions now. I've been talking for too long. Time to give you a call. Give some questions. Share some experiences. Okay, so I'll just repeat the question because it's a bit hard to hear. I think that's pretty much what it's like. You said you were asking whether the idea of wrapping the meditation up, I mean, applies in metta or whether it applies in mindfulness meditation and other practices as well. Could apply every meditation. Every meditation, if you're mindfully a beginner, you have a time and a place. All these things are supported in meditation. You have a time and a place, the beginner. You go to a place to sit down with a posture, and then give it a certain period of time and then you end it. And then you've got like a container for what goes on in there. I first started reflecting and thinking about this a few years ago. We were teaching a course here as it happens on Buddhism and psychotherapy. And I was talking to one of the students who does music therapy. And we had quite an interesting conversation, because I used to be a musician, so it was interesting for me to see that. Talk to her about how she was using it. And some of the things that came out of that conversation, I think for me, was the understanding of the way that music works with the emotions. Right? So music is very interesting, because on the one hand, it's entirely mathematical. Right? Music is rigidly mathematical, right? If you know how pop songs are constructed, right? It's fours and eights and they divide into each other and it's almost ridiculous how rigid the mathematics are and how tiny are the variations that you can actually make from that. Right? And yet it's of course the most emotional of all art forms, right? And it's just like a tarot. Why is that? Why is it that music allows you to express those feelings, right? And so that's what you realize, that precisely because it's so mathematical and so rigid, right? That's what provides the container that allows you to express all those emotions, right?
while knowing that there's a sense of order all around it. And that's why people can get up on karaoke night and sing, oh, I will always love you, or these kinds of things, which you would never do in public, right? Unless it's in a song. But the song gives you a container, and you know that after 3 minutes it's going to come to an end. Yeah? Yeah? And it's got those boundaries and that magical structure. So that's the same thing applies to meditation. It's the very fact that it has the container which gives you the limits that gives you a feeling of safety so that anything can happen within that meditation. Okay. And then whatever happens, it can. Well, you can, but you're going to meditate on a train, that's fine. But again, the same principle would apply. If you're sitting on a train, you consciously begin the meditation and then you consciously end before you get up or whatever. Okay. And so just remember to keep those containers around. But you're not going to be able to meditate as deeply on a train as you meditate at home or you meditate in the meditation center, right? And if you start crying, for example, how many people who have meditated on a train and started crying? Well, maybe some have, but it's not very likely, is it? Yeah. But anybody who's done any kind of deep meditation will know that sometimes you cry. Yeah. It happens. All kinds of things can happen. Yeah. So, you know, just understand that that's not a substitute. That's why I'm cautious about it, because I think sometimes people can take these things as a substitute for the real thing. That's not to say they're bad, it's a good thing to do, but it's not a substitute for the real thing. Yeah. You know, we're getting a whole new generation of meditators now. I had this lady on my last retreat who was a bit confused, because I wanted to talk to the new meditators, right, at the beginning of the retreat. I always say, those who haven't practiced before, please come and we'll talk. And she wasn't sure whether she should be there. She said she'd only done meditation with apps before. Right? She was an app-only meditator. Right? So she didn't know whether that means she'd done proper meditation or not. So we use all these kind of things which can help in some ways, and they can give you some kind of guidance and support back from the beginning. But at the end of the day, with meditation, it's very challenging. Right? Meditation is just you staring straight into your own mind, right? And there's nowhere to hide. Yeah? And all of the conceits and all of the ideas and all of the labels and the names and the concepts and the status and all of those things that we normally use to insulate ourselves and protect ourselves and develop that sense of self, all of those things fall away bit by bit by bit. And then you're just looking at your own mind and there's no excuses. And you can't blame anybody. No, I'm saying that they don't naturally transfer to your everyday life. I'm saying you have to consciously reflect on it and deliberately bring it into your day-to-day life. Okay, let me give you some examples. Do some mental meditation. You have a trap meditation. Right? Yeah? What does that mean? Well, you get out, come out of the meditation, you're in a bad mood and stuff like that. You're walking along the road, you meet somebody who you know and they give you a cheery smile and say hello. Right? How do you respond to that? Right? Well, you could respond to that by saying, get out of here. Right? Or you could respond to that by saying, oh, now I've got some happiness. Right? I've been feeling so down and now this person is here and I feel so happy to be with them. Right? And the very fact that you felt sad and depressed after doing a bad meditation means you feel even more relief and joy to meet that person. Yeah? So what you do in your meditation doesn't determine what happens when you meet that person. Right? It might influence it, but it depends on what you do when you meet that person. Right? And similarly, maybe you have a great meditation. You sit there and feel, so much messed up, all kinds of things, may they all be happy, right? What happens then, right?
you go down to the shop, yeah? And the person who's serving at this point is like really obnoxious to you, right? So what do you do? Yeah? Ah, I'm a great metta meditator, I'm gonna blast him with metta and then I'll give you what I want, right? Maybe you have to, yeah? Again, that's your kind of choice, right? And of course, a real, you could be in the same situation and then think, oh, that person must be suffering, yeah? So the fact that they're lashing out at me or being obnoxious to me means they must have suffering in their heart. So why don't I act in a way that's not, at least not going to increase their suffering, right? So then you bring some wisdom and genuine compassion to it. Again, what you've done in the meditation will influence those, right? But it's not going to determine it. And how you act in those circumstances depends on what you do at that time. It doesn't depend on what you've done in your meditation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I have the feeling that
Again, I'm not saying we're completely independent. I'm really saying that we're different kinds of things. Okay? Ken will be used the phrase relatively independent. Okay. Relatively independent. These separate factors of the eightfold path that need to be developed. It's very important. This is I think a major form of Buddhist kind of emotional denialism. Right? We avoid practicing the Eightfold Path by pretending we're practicing another part of the Eightfold Path. Right? So if you're in a situation where you're getting in a conflict with somebody and misunderstanding with them, well, actually, the part of the Eightfold Path you need to be practicing is right speech. Okay? But instead, you just shut up and I'll just wish them maybe happy and so on. And then I sort of get out of that to actually have that difficult conversation with them, you know? Yeah. So we need to do what's actually relevant at that time, yeah? And not try to use meditation as a kind of cover-up for all the other problems and issues that we have. Yeah. Okay, another question.
This question, but like when you mentioned that like Buddhism and meditation is always based in real things, and the animation love and kindness. That's what makes me feel happy. Oh, I have that in me.
Ah.
No, but then you know, start out, and you're going to say that, you know, the meditation, the action, so they have. You have necklace, but you still have the situation. And then I thought, so you have to prepare your mind first, and things like that when all mind likes to believe it is structured so that you start to use this thing. And then to be able to act in that way. And that's easy. If you're not meditating, you prepare your mind, but you just act in that way. Does that have an effect in your mind as well?
Sure. So somebody maybe is not even a spiritual practitioner, but they live a good life and do things at the time and so on, and is that going to have an effect and an influence on their mind? And of course it will do, right? And of course you're developing all of those wholesome qualities which are essential for practicing meditation. But also you'd be kind of surprised about this because it's not... Again, it's not a simple one-to-one relationship. I remember when one of the things is one of the things you learn when you teach retreats, because you hear, you know, how many 50, 60 people suffering on the retreat, and they all give the same teachings to every one of them.
Right? You sit at the front and give the same talk, and all of them come with something completely different from it. Right? And they all come and have completely different experiences. Completely different kinds of experiences, right? One person says, oh, I've sat there, you know, so happy, really, so easy, right? Another person's like, oh my god, my life's falling apart. And then the other two, some people are going through really different emotional journeys, and so many different kinds of things that happen, right? One of the things that you sometimes see is that sometimes people who seem to be the most loving can't be better meditators. They're like really kind people. They're like, it's so sweet and so giving and so loving all the time. And then they say, well, I'll do better meditation and can't do anything. Again, it's not to say that these things don't influence each other, but to say that the connection is not obvious, it's not simple. They can affect each other in all different kinds of ways. So in that kind of case, if somebody who is genuinely very loving, you can see that through their actions and their speech, right? And they're a very kind person, then maybe the metta meditation isn't going all that, you know, they don't feel any metta in the metta meditation. But surely it's there. Yeah? So surely after some time or with some patience or something like that, you know that maybe they'll be able to find it. Yeah? And it will develop well when they can. But you know, maybe there's some other issue there, maybe there's some perception or something that's not allowing them to develop that. So it really is quite amazing the different things that people go through on the retreats. Some people sitting there having such good meditation the whole time, and then other people sitting there, and one retreat I gave recently, one of the fellows on the retreat was a cop. And he was specifically a cop in the, it was like, I don't know what they call it, it's like the SWAT team or something like that. Basically, he was one of the guys who had to go into the most dangerous situations. And their whole training was to say, when everybody else goes away, you go forward. Right? And he's just sitting there absolutely hyper-vigilant in meditation, right? Everybody else is trying to say, be awake, be aware, and so on. For him, like saying, go to sleep, right? He's just sitting there. Slightest noise, he's ready to leap up. And all of the conditioning affects us all in so many different ways. Okay, other bit.
I just was beginning when you practice, where's your retreat?
Ah, where do I practice?
Yeah, like where's your retreat?
Kind of around the place. I'm downstairs at the moment. I theoretically stay at Bodhinyana Monastery in Perth that I can grant, but I've only been there for about 2 weeks in the last 6 months. So that's fairly abstract concept of residence at the moment. I've been travelling a lot, something like that. Yeah, I don't have a fixed abode as such, but most of the time when I'm staying in monastery these days, I'm in Perth with other brahmins. But for 10 years I was at Santi Monastery in Bandung, but now that's a nun's community, so I still go down and visit sometimes. But, yeah.